Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is film composer Richard Gibbs. But first, I want to talk about something that most musicians and producers don't know about, and that's tax credits for music production. Most states have an arts council where they will provide either tax credits or grants that will help you finish or will reimburse you for some of the costs of a production. Now, this started with mostly film and television, but now many states have also extended that to music projects as well. Probably the one that really stands out is Louisiana, where up until the end of the year, when it's changing, Louisiana had really generous tax credits, so much so that many of the films from California actually shipped out to Louisiana to do most of the production. I know this firsthand because my neighbor is a carpenter for Universal, and she actually moved for the last year to Louisiana, to New Orleans, to work on, I think it was three different feature films. The bad part about that is, in Louisiana anyway, at the end of the year, that tax credit is shutting down. So that doesn't mean that other states aren't doing it, though. You'll find that Georgia, for instance, will give you a rebate of up to 30% of what you spend making an album. Of course, the real trick is you have to go there and make the album there. So if you're not from Georgia, you can still take advantage of it. You just have to move there during the production of your album. Texas also has a rebate program. New York is lobbying for $60 million that it can spend on tax credits for the arts. So you'll find that most states will have at least some money to spend on the arts. The problem is that states aren't very good at getting the word out. So you have to go search for it. Sometimes they have a rather generous amount of money to be able to spend on this, but they're so poor at getting the word out that they don't spend it. And really, we can do ourselves a favor by actually doing a Google search. Whatever state you live in, do a Google search and look for the state name plus the arts or music tax credit. So you'll do Georgia, for instance, Georgia music tax credit or Georgia arts tax credits. And then you'll see a number of links that will come up that will take you to the application forms and will show you just what's viable and what isn't. Of course, Canada has had this in place for a long, long time. Canada has an arts council that gives grants for just about anything that's artistic, and they've been very good at helping Canadian artists and musicians and producers for a very long time. And now the U.S., the states, are actually getting involved in that. So it's something very cool and something you should look into. The next thing I want to talk about is why we love music. Yeah, we all love it, or else we wouldn't be doing it, and you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you didn't love music, and I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't love music. The fact of the matter is, we haven't had a lot of concrete answers as to why we love music for a long time. Well, that's all changed. There's a new study called the Neurochemistry of Music that really analyzed the brain functions of when we listen to music. And they found out a number of different things. The first thing they found was that our prefrontal cortex was stimulated whenever we hear music that we like. And what this meant was we would actually get certain memories that were connected to music, certain music. So in other words, we hear something that we connect with a certain part of our lives, which is kind of cool. But the other thing that they found out, or another thing they found out, was that the neurons in our auditory cortex in our brain actually synchronize with the beat, which is kind of cool. So basically, our brain is synchronizing with the beat of music that we like. Another thing they found is that favorite songs trigger brain pleasure points, and as a result, release serotonin and dopamine, which is the drugs that make us feel good. So music really is a drug in a way, because music that we like stimulates the release of those drugs that make us feel good. Another thing that they found is this happens to everybody. So it doesn't matter how old or how young you are, or if you listen to music or if you like music a lot, it does happen because there are sounds that we really like. The thing about it is, though, it happens more when you're young. So between 12 and 22 is when this happens most intensely. And that kind of explains something. It explains why the biggest music buying public is 12 to 22. That's because it's stimulating a part of our brain that's really making us feel good. And of course, the older we get, it still happens, but it happens less and less. As a result of this, though, is when we're young, the music that we love gets hardwired into our brain, which is kind of why we grow up liking the music from that particular era. And we probably like other music as well, but we don't like it as much as what we grew up with. So there's a real good reason for all of this, for the things that we've been seeing in music for the longest time. Finally, music is part of our self-image when we're young. It really is part of us. And that diminishes over time. The older we get, the less that matters to us. So you can see that there really are things happening within our brain that explains why we like music and why there's certain music that we really stay with for most of our lives. It's something that gets hardwired in because it gives us the most intense pleasure when we're young. And that explains a lot, doesn't it? It explains a lot about music and explains why we love it so much and why we continue to love it as we get older. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, which is 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. And you can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. That's 101mixingtricks.com. My guest today is composer Richard Gibbs. Richard was a member of the 80s cult band Oingo Boingo, and then he was a noted studio musician. He's also scored more than 40 feature films, as well as television series like The Simpsons and Battlestar Galactica. Richard also owns one of my all-time favorite studios, which is the very unique Woodshed Recording in Malibu. I spoke with Richard via phone from his home in Malibu. Well, I'm here with Richard Gibbs, one of my most favorite people in the whole world. He's not only a fantastic film composer, but he's a great person as well. And I always love talking to him. So thank you for being with me today, Richard.
Wow, I can't possibly live up to those accolades, but I'll do my best.
I'm sure you will. Let's start way back in the beginning. How did a kid from Florida wind up being a famous film composer?
Well, I take issue with the word famous, but Florida, yes, not exactly a hotbed of, you know, film activity, but I had some friends when I was a kid growing up, some guys that I looked up to that were surfers who were older than me, these two brothers, and they started making surf movies. And back in the day, you know, you could look it up, as they say, but surf movies are a whole different subculture where the filmmakers would make the movies 16 millimeter and make it without sound and then edit it together. And there were just these little surf travelogues, and they would tour from town to town playing in high school, junior college auditoriums, wherever they could rent a hall and charge $1 each for surfers to come watch other surfers, you know, hopefully really good surfers, do their thing in surf spots all over the world. And they would narrate it and then play music behind it. And that is in that capacity. These brothers came to me and said, hey, can you, I had the biggest record collection, I think, in Daytona at the time. And I was 16 and said, can you put something together that will play behind us while we're, you know, while we're narrating this movie? Live narration every time. So I ended up putting together a compilation on a Radio Shack cassette player and, you know, just putting the needle down on the record at the right time. I timed out and watched the movie, timed out where all the scenes happened with a stopwatch, and figured out what would work best in every, you know, in every instance as best I could, and put it all on a cassette, you know, kind of the ultimate mixtape. And then I toured with them, playing my little Radio Shack cassette player through a Fender Showman amplifier in front of an audience. So in a way, it was I've never thought about it till just now, but in a way, it was the best introduction to film music because it was completely connected with the audience. I got to see live every time when I put a piece of music up against, even though it wasn't my music, and I also didn't realize when I was 16 that that's completely illegal what we were doing. But I didn't know anything from copyright law then, as most 16-year-olds don't, especially in Florida. So I'm playing it, and as I'm playing it, you could feel the audience. It's just like being in a live band. It was like live film scoring in a way, and I could tell what worked and what didn't every night. And it really taught me a lot, and it also really inspired me, the idea of putting music to image. Again, even though it wasn't my music, I was basically an outlaw music supervisor at that point, but I got the gist of it from that. So that was the inspiration. It really started there before I was, I think probably the answer that most people would think I would give is, well, I went to Berklee College of Music, which is true. And that's where I studied film scoring and off and running from there.
When you were doing the live thing, were you doing the same, or were you playing the same music all the time, or were you, was it random?
It wasn't random. It was choreographed, for lack of a better word. But I would change it. I would learn, oh, that didn't really work. I mean, Allman Brothers works great there, but not in that next scene. And then I would, slug in King Crimson or whatever it was. And I could see when the audience reacted, what they were reacting to, what worked better, what gave the scene life. It's one thing to watch it by yourself and get a reaction, but as we all knew, any of us, when we're involved in any kind of artistic endeavor, you can paint something, you can write a poem, you can do anything, and the second somebody else hears it or sees it, that's when it comes to life, and that's when you realize where the strengths and the weaknesses are. It's in other people's reactions. And I got that, the benefit of that, with that music every night. It was really very educational. So I would change it up a little bit, according to what seemed like would work.
That's awesome. I never knew that story, but you know what? That's cool, and I could see how that could be really helpful.
It really was. It wasn't a straight line from there to becoming a film composer, but it was buried in my subconscious,
So then you went to Berklee, you studied film composition, you get out of Berklee, and then what happened?
Well, honestly, I didn't go to Berklee to study film composition. I went to Berklee to become a jazz rock star. I wanted to be Joe Zawinul or Jan Hammer. I wanted to be a fusion guy. I was a keyboard player. But while I was there, my degree was in classical composition. And the only way I could make my father happy was to get a degree, an accredited degree of some sort. And at the time, Berklee didn't offer an accredited degree in performance. So the only accredited degree that I could get that I was interested in was composition. So that was where I really learned my classical composition. So I actually owe my father kind of a backhanded, compliment for that. Yeah. That wasn't his intent. He just didn't want me to go to music school at all.
Yeah, sure.
But in any case, so I came out here after graduation to make my way as a keyboardist, not as a composer. So I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Yeah, you are. So is that where you learned how to orchestrate at Berklee, or did you learn later on from the tutelage of somebody, or how did that happen? Because that's, especially when you're talking film composition, that's something that's really important. I don't know. I think it's as important as the composition itself.
Well, it can be, it definitely can be. I mean, obviously it's not as important for a solo piano piece, but when you're writing for an orchestra, you need to know how the orchestra works. One of the cool things about Berklee, and I think probably most music schools when you're studying composition, is that they insist that you learn how to play at least one instrument out of every family of instruments. So I learned how to play cello, violin. I already played trombone, so I didn't have to pick up brass. I learned how to play sax and clarinet and percussion. Now, mind you, on every one of those instruments, my qualifications are such that I can torture dogs. That's about it. But at least you learn the limitations and the sweet spots in the instrument and how to. And it really helps me to think when I'm writing. I try to imagine myself playing the part. And when I write down a line, especially back in the day when I did it all pencil and paper, I would actually, as I'm writing it, I'm imagining myself, or hopefully somebody good, playing that part, and you breathe with it, and hear, you know, you feel the articulation and the dynamics and all of that. That's the beginning of orchestration to me. I studied orchestration, but not so much. I more was studying when I was at Berkeley. I was studying arranging, which is a different, you know, a related but different skill.
Yeah, right. Well, just as important, really, when it comes down to
yeah,
it. Well,
yeah, definitely. But I was always more interested in the actual composition and the arrangement and the orchestration. I never called myself an orchestrator until when I was out here, although, funny enough, I've never orchestrated my own scores. Most composers you'll find don't orchestrate for themselves, not because they're not capable of it, but because they generally don't have time. And also, a really, really good orchestrator is a specialist, just like a good book editor. You know, it's somebody who can really take what you've done and hone it and put that final polish on it with an objective eye and ear. And I've served in that capacity for other people, but never for myself.
But yeah, don't you have to do it when you're doing something in the box, for instance, where it's all, you know, when you're doing a cheap score, for instance? I shouldn't say cheap, but, you know, an inexpensive score.
No, you're right. Cheap works. I hate doing scores like that. I truly don't find any joy in that. It's lifeless to me in every way. I'm orchestrating, and I understand orchestration enough to do that. But again, if I'm writing for a live orchestra and I have a great orchestrator working for me, and I've only worked with great orchestrators, they just take it to another level. They do a fine. Now, my training is such that my sketches, my initial writing, I used to have a copyist, you know, the people who actually write the notes. Well, now it's all done with computers, but there's still somebody who supervises it. They would come to me and say, we could copy off of your sketches. We don't need the orchestrated scores. We could work right off your sketches because they're that complete. So, my sketches would be such that all the instrumentation is identified. What the orchestrator would do is maybe just kind of, again, just edit it, add little changes here and there, change the weighting of how many first violins play one part as opposed to the second violins on the harmony part, whatever it might be. They would do that kind of, or they would help me with how many, you know, the size of the orchestra, what would be the balance within the orchestra, what would be the best number of players.
What was your first score?
I'm trying to remember. It's been so long. The first score I did was for I hadn't even scored a television show or a commercial or anything. The first score I did was for a movie called Sweetheart's Dance, and for a guy named Robert Greenwald, who I still revere. He was the director. Robert is best known now as the guy behind Brave New Films. Hmm. And, you know, this great, fantastic left-wing rabble-rouser trying to keep Fox News and everybody else honest. But back then, he was doing a feature film, and it had Jeff Daniels, Susan Sarandon, Don Johnson. And Elizabeth Perkins. And it was this romantic comedy, and it was more of a romance than a comedy, and it was a sweet story for TriStar Pictures. He wanted how it came to me was he didn't want to work with a film composer. He wanted to work with somebody who could arrange pre-existing songs. He had this vision in his head of having some Elvis Presley songs. He had a version of California Girls as done by David Lee Roth that he wanted to use in the movie, but he wanted it to coalesce into score at one point, to have it kind of morph. And so I had a mutual friend who recommended me, actually a couple of different people recommended me to him, and I went and met with him, and the first thing he said to me was, I don't want to hire a film composer. I just looked at him and said, not a problem, I'm not a film composer. I've never scored anything. I'm here. How can I help you? And he tells me what he wants, and I'm quick enough on my feet that I knew how to answer it. I knew how to do exactly what he wanted, just in theory, and in practice it ended up being exactly what I did. And of course, as we got into the movie and, you know, I'm doing these adaptations, it became clear that there were plenty of scenes that needed original music, and he recognized that, and so I ended up with my first film scoring credit. And to kind of go quickly into what launched me, that led indirectly to a job as Tracy Ullman's musical director for her show on Fox called The Tracy Ullman Show. The music supervisor on that movie, on Sweetheart's Dance, knew somebody at Fox, knew about this opening, recommended me. I went in there, interviewed, said the right things, got the job, and there was a little-known short on that show that was a one-minute animated short called The Simpsons. That was the birth of The Simpsons, was on the Tracy Ullman Show.
Yeah.
And I befriended Matt Groening every once in a while, not often, but every once in a while, he would need just a little piece of source music or something. So I would do it for him just as because it was part of the Tracy Ullman Show, and that was my job. And then they spun it off into its own series, which was basically, from my perspective, kind of a Hail Mary. The Fox Network was hurting back then. They were not doing well. And their biggest hit was,
Married with Children, wasn't it?
Married with Children, yeah. And then Tracy was kind of a distant second, I think. So they were just saying, well, they were open to do anything, wide open network. And Jim Brooks pitched to them the idea of doing a primetime cartoon, which is pretty radical when you think about it. It certainly was at the time, but they had nothing to lose because they were going down. So they did it. Matt asked me to score the series. They, without even consulting me or even knowing any connection, they hired Danny Elfman to write the theme, not knowing that I had been the keyboard player in Oingo Boingo, which, of course, Danny was the singer in.
Yeah.
So it was this giant coincidence. So I scored the first season of The Simpsons. Danny wrote the theme, and I did all the other music. And I actually had a producer come to me at one point and say, we're really glad to have you doing this, that you're doing this, but I don't know if you're familiar with the music of Danny Elfman. Do you think he can write in his style? And I looked at him incredulously and said, really? I was in the band with the guy for 5 years. I think if anybody can knock him off, it'd be me. So that was really fun, and it was a big launching point because the show, of course, was pretty much an overnight hit. You know, nobody saw that coming. And people started calling, wanting the guys that did the music for that show. And Danny certainly was launched off. He was already on his way at that point, but it definitely bootstrapped me up. I also got the reputation of being the guy who put out fires. And I replaced like four or five different scores back then where you know, the movie was in trouble, the score wasn't working, whatever. And they would call me up and say, okay, you got 2 weeks to rescore this whole movie because we have a release date and we're not happy with the music. And I'd go to work, which was, you know, I enjoy that. I actually like, not that I like replacing somebody else's work, I don't, but I do like working under pressure. It doesn't freak me out.
Wow. I mean, that's super pressure because, I mean, you don't have much time to do a score anyway, but when you have even less than that, geez.
I set the record twice with in two different movies. think the first one was Big Mama's House, and that wasn't a replacement score. It was a score where the composer had to drop out due to a schedule shift. They had moved the release date up on Big Mama's House, and there wasn't so that composer had to fall out. He couldn't do it, and I was available, and they asked me, could I fill in? I said, sure, I'll do it, and I had 11 days to score it. And then I did another one that had a similar kind of thing where they moved schedule. Again, nobody was fired. It was just their schedule shifted, and I had 9 days to score that one. So I that was kind of the record, at least at Fox. And then, from what I understand, Team America smashed that record. I think they did a rescore of that in 7 days.
I was just talking to a friend of mine who worked on Team America. He did the sound effects, Scott Gershon. He was telling me some of the stories about working on that movie and about how crazy it was and how they never went home. they just worked right up until the last minute and slept in the studio, and you know how crazy it was and all the changes that were happening at the last minute, et cetera, et cetera. So, which is why I don't think they've done another movie since.
No, I guess they haven't. Well, they did a musical, of course.
Yeah, right.
So they're doing okay.
Yeah, I'm sure they are, definitely. Film scoring has changed since you started, and it's changed a lot. Where do you see it going?
Right now I could insert the cynic, but I won't. Everything's cyclical, right? I mean, before I came on the scene, now I'm, one of the old guys. But when I started scoring, I was a young pup. That was back in the 80s. But before that, in the 70s, film score had shifted away from orchestral, the old school, old style film scoring of the 50s, to more, people were experimenting and then solidifying more and codifying more and more of a jazz and rock and roll approach to scores, and even early synth scores, Clockwork Orange and movies like that. And it looked like the orchestra was dead. People weren't going to write orchestral scores. It was pretty much a dying business then. I'm not talking in the 70s. And then this little movie called Star Wars comes out, and John Williams writes this fantastic score, and suddenly everybody wants to do sci-fi movies again. But more than that, everybody wanted that sound, that fantastic sound that only a well-written orchestral piece can bring. And then there was a renaissance in film scoring in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, and I rode that wave. I was one of those guys, me and Danny and Graham Rafael and Basil Polidorus and, a bunch of us. We're all the beneficiaries of that wave of orchestral film scoring. Now we're kind of in this other era that we're on a downward swing of quality of film score again, but there'll be another Star Wars, there'll be something else that comes along that, reignites the imagination. I hold out for that.
Yeah, I do a lecture at colleges, a clinic, and it's called The Music Business Is Not Dead. And I start off by saying, okay, here's the time period. So there was lots of piracy happening, and there was a recession, and the music business was the worst it's ever been. Everybody thought it was over. What year is it? And everybody says, 1996, 2003, whatever. And I say, 1980. And of course,
right.
After that came the CD. Excuse me. After that came the CD, and everything changed, and it grew to bigger heights, larger heights than anybody ever thought. So, as you say, everything is cyclical, and when things look at their worst and when they're really down, of course, that's, just about the time something new is going to happen, revitalize everything.
Yeah, I do see to look at that larger picture right with you. I'm actually extremely excited about the future of music overall and the future of art overall. We're in a absolutely in a pit right now. We're in a ditch, but there are very positive things on the horizon. Now that I hold that streaming and all manner of streaming is our biggest hope. That as that becomes more popularly accepted, people get out of this notion of carrying around hard drives and carrying around their music, and it's all being downloaded and streamed from the cloud or wherever. Now we've got some means of gatekeeping again, and there'll be some means of monetizing it once again. It will happen. Right now, Spotify is, we're just at the very beginning stages of this. We're kind of where radio was when radio first came on the scene. People didn't know what to make of radio vis-a-vis musical copyright. And that was the advent of BMI and ASCAP. And it was an ugly birth. That's where we are now. We're at that same period. It might be 5 years, it might be 10 years, but it will get worked out. I would only say the music business is dead or the movie business is dead when people aren't watching movies or listening to music. But that's not the case. If anything, it's the opposite. People are listening to more music now than ever before in history. So the demand is there. The problem is the delivery system has been broken for a while, and it'll get fixed. Well, there's too much money in it.
To some degree, it's also the fact that the gatekeepers have been scattered, and now you have to really sift through a lot of mediocre music, mediocre films, mediocre art in order to get to the great stuff. And, but again, it's in the eye of the beholder, and something that I don't like, you may love, and vice versa. But even so, there's a level of quality that at least the gatekeepers of the major labels, upheld that you don't see now. But I think it's coming back.
No, I do too. I mean, talk to Ian Rogers. I'm sure I imagine you've talked to him on here, but... Oh, actually, he can't talk right now.
Yeah, no, we can't.
He's not allowed to talk anymore. Now he works for Apple.
Yeah.
But that's all about, that's exactly what he's doing with iTunes Radio, and what he was doing with Beats Music was establishing, I don't think he uses the word gatekeepers, but let's say tastemakers, people that you trust and you go to, just like back in the day when you and I were kids, we all had our favorite DJs who we listened to. Well, that guy gets, I like his taste in music, and, at least 80% of the time he's going to play something I like, so I listen to his show. Now we're just going to have the internet version of that. And the beauty of it is there'll be a lot of those guys, and it'll be a lot easier for you to find different tastemakers than it used to be. It used to be there were only so many stations on the dial. Now there's an infinite choice, and you just the cream will rise to the top. I'm sure of that.
Yeah,
it'll be an exciting day.
I think you're right, definitely. I want to get back to film composition for a second, because there's a question I've always had about this. I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear it from you. So how important is the relationship that you have with the director in the grand scheme of working all the time?
Well, in the grand scheme of working all the time, you mean in terms of getting further work? I mean, that's important,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, from the standpoint that once you get in with the director, does that mean you're going to get all of his films after that?
Well, one would hope, right? I mean, if you do a good job painting somebody's house, you hope they'll call you back in 3 years when the paint starts to get ragged.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of thing. If you have a good working relationship with anybody in any walk of life, you hope that they call you back. And there certainly have been, many classic cases of director-composer collaborations. They tend to outlast any other collaboration, director-actor or producer, director, or whatever. There's something about that. That relationship is really important. And of course, Steven Spielberg's never worked with anybody but John Williams. My old compatriot Danny Elfman, it's done all of Tim Burton's films except one. So there's a lot to be said for that. I definitely have directors that I work with and call me back time and time again. And what happens is you get a shorthand when you work with a director. You don't, you know, they trust you. You trust them too, equally importantly. You know, I trust when Betty Thomas tells me something sucks. You know, I trust that she doesn't dislike me. She just, and it, I know she's being honest with me. It doesn't work for her, and I'm not offended by it in the least. I go, okay, now let's get to, let me change this because I know how to get what you want. I'm not scared by it. I trust the relationship, and we arrive at something that we're both happy with. It's super important that the director-composer relationship, super important. And that is something that I'm seeing being frittered away a little bit, being chipped away at by some of the modern methods of filmmaking. I think that's been hurt a bit.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, there are kind of old ways of working that really did have good reason for being, even though some of the technology makes it no longer necessary. The idea of sitting down with the director had to finish the film first, by and large, before a composer could really get to work. That's no longer true. The film is never finished anymore until it's wrested out of the filmmaker's hands right before release. But it used to be that because of the process of actually cutting film and cutting negative, that they had what they called a locked picture. And that's just become an anachronistic term now. A picture is never locked. They can always open it up with the computer and re-edit it at any moment. And the same goes with the music. It's always shifting, and it's moving around. So what that means is everything becomes a bit more remote. Like, people send files back and forth, and whereas back in the day when I was writing a score for a picture, the director would come over to my studio, we'd sit down, I'd sit at the piano and play him what I was thinking, talk it through, and we're really connecting on what that should sound like and what that should mean emotionally, and we're eye to eye and really working through it. Whereas now, you know, more especially younger filmmakers, they expect to send me the picture in bits and chunks, and I score a scene and I send the mock-up back over to them, you know, via, it's just a file, and there's no eye to eye, there's not as much emotional connection with what goes on. And I think that's a loss for filmmaking by and large. To me, my biggest criticism of film music these days, it is starting to sound more and more like music design and not music composition. And there's a key difference.
Wow. That, I've never heard anyone explain it that way, but I see your point.
I actually had a music supervisor say that term to me 20 years ago. Say, oh, so glad they're going to be working with you. You know, you're going to be designing the music, and I'm going to be... And I stopped him cold. It was just a phone conversation. So wait, I'm not going to say his name, but wait, don't say that. He goes, what? I said, don't say that I'm designing music. I don't design music. I compose music. It's a huge difference. Please don't say that ever again.
Yeah.
It was okay. You're like, what's your problem? But okay. But now, what I hear, so many film scores, to me, are interchangeable. There's very little sense of melodic through composition. There's very little sense of arc of the telling of the story from beginning to end. I don't leave a theater humming a melody. It's just not there. It's just kind of noise. It's like musical sound effects. And it sounds like I'm such a curmudgeon, and I don't feel that way. But, you know, every once in a while, a beautiful score comes out of the murk, and boy, does it stand out. You know, I'm in the Academy, so I vote for, you know, nominate best scores, and it used to be I was kind of overwhelmed. I was like, oh, it's really hard to get it down to just 5 movies that had great scores. Now I have a really hard time finding 2 that I think are worthy. I don't hear it. And a couple of years, was it 2 years ago when War Horse came out? I hadn't seen War Horse, but I'd seen all the other movies and was kind of reviewing all the scores and listening to it. And there were some good scores. I know there was some stuff that was fine. And so I never did watch War Horse. And I popped it in my DVD player, and that opening scene with John Williams' score for War Horse, my jaw drops. And, oh, my God, I forgot what film scoring was until I listened to that. It's just head and shoulders above everything else. And this makes it sound like I'm the biggest John Williams fan on the planet. And I am a fan, but there are plenty of others that I've always revered as well. What a difference. What a difference emotionally to the movie. What that does for a movie, a well-written score, well-orchestrated, well-thought through. And there's not enough of that. To me, it's cookie-cutter now mentality. And I could point fingers as to why that is, and I don't want to do that publicly.
Yeah. Well, you know, believe me, when you talk about being a curmudgeon, you are the least curmudgeonly of anyone I know. I mean, you're very hip. You're very on top of it. You've always, I know, as long as I've known you, you've tried to be that. I don't think you've tried. You are. There's a difference.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. But speaking of which, let's talk about your studio.
Okay.
Because I think your studio is one of the most well thought out facilities in order to make music. It's not your typical studio whatsoever. And I keep on telling everybody, and I think I've told you this, you know, I've been in hundreds of studios all over the world, everywhere. Everyone wants to show me their studio.
Sure.
Yours is top five for me, for sure.
You told me that, and it flattered me to no end.
It's just a fantastic place. How did that all come about?
Well, like you, I've been in hundreds of studios all over the world, you know, in different capacities. And, I've always picked up little things in this studio and that studio that I liked. And like every other film, every film composer needs to have his own studio of some sort. You need to have a place to work when you're writing that's yours, because we all have our own way of working. And I've always had something like that. And it was always some, you know, a converted room in the converted bedroom, a converted guest house, a converted room above the garage or whatever. But a couple of things happened. I was suddenly made a boatload of money on a particular movie. They paid me exceptionally well. And I wanted to invest in myself, in my own career. And so I'm going to build my dream studio. I've got the money now. You know, a smarter person would have invested in stocks or something else. But I said, you know, I've always had this idea in my head as to how a studio would work for me, what I like about a studio. And I designed it from my point of view. And I use the word design very loosely. I'm not an architect. I'm not a studio designer. So maybe I should say I conceptualized it and then hired architect and a studio designer to help with that. But the idea was I designed it for my own purposes. I didn't design it for anybody else's use. I designed it just for mine, and it just so happened, because I'm a film composer and sometime record producer, that I needed a place that was amazingly flexible. It also just so happened that my property overlooks the ocean in Malibu, so it was a spectacular setting, and I didn't want to in any way impinge on that view of the ocean. So it automatically just became bright and airy with, you know, French doors and windows all around. And we just, you know, it's just one of those, you know, moments in time, a confluence of events. California Coastal Commission and the city of Malibu were very strict on their rules, and it really slowed us down in the design process. And because of that, I had more time to tinker and think and kind of move models around and play around with lines on paper and come up with different ideas and apply different ideas, and came up with what is now Woodshed Recording. And it's a unique spot. I mean, all the interior walls move, everything changes depending on what you're doing. I've always liked craftsman architecture. I had the money to go out and buy the best woods that we could, both for sound and for appearance, and We just went for it. It was just, there was really no limit. We just said, okay, we're just going to build the best studio we can, given this size space. And that was actually part of it, too, was that because of the city of Malibu, I couldn't build any bigger. I couldn't make the footprint any bigger than it is. So we had to maximize the use of that space. So that necessitated a lot of, kind of inventions of how a studio functions with all these movable walls and flexible wiring plans and so on.
For those of you listening to this, there's several interesting things. Well, there's more than several. We can go on and on about how your studio, Woodshed Recording, differs from the traditional studio. One of the things, though, is there's so much glass in it. And you can see the ocean, you can see the mountains, you can see whatever from there, and you can open up the windows, and it still sounds good, and it feels good, and the breeze blows through, and it's just an amazingly comfortable place.
Well, the thing that I found is, again, I designed it for me. I was just spoiling myself, and I'm not an engineer. I don't pretend to be an engineer. I don't have those chops. When guys were learning how to engineer, I was learning how to arrange and orchestrate. It's an equally important skill that I never learned. So I didn't look at it from the point of view of an engineer, and I realized after the fact that most studios are built by engineers, or at least built for engineers, or with an engineer in mind. I didn't take in any input from an engineer at all. I looked at it solely from my point of view as somebody who's writing the music and is playing the instruments. And I wanted it to feel good. That was the most important thing to me, was the beauty of creation. That was it. And that really did, those sound like empty words, but it really did affect the design of the studio fairly radically. And I fully expected when we were finished building it that there were going to be all sorts of flaws. There were going to be a lot of problems with this studio because we did break so many rules. As you say, lots of glass all the way around. And well, that's a problem acoustically. We found ways to get around that. And then in other ways, we also found, here's the other thing. I'm digressing here, but it's fairly common that people talk about things like, a neutral room or a natural sound, or that's all BS. There's no such thing as neutral. There's no such thing as natural. We're dealing with converting, sound waves into electrons. We're done at that point. You can't talk to me about what's natural anymore.
Yeah.
It's only a matter of what you like and what makes you comfortable. And I realize it's more important as the creator of the music that I feel comfortable when I'm coming up with the music. That the emotion comes through more than the technical aspects, much more. It's much more important. And at least for me, right? That's how I was thinking about it when I was sitting there sketching out plans with the architect and going through it. But what surprised me was when all was said and done was how many other musicians came in here and felt exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And this is how I want to work. Yeah. This is fantastic. And suddenly people are renting it. And it's become this other source of income that I honestly wasn't expecting at all.
Yeah, you're getting heavy hitters in there too. From U2 to Barbra Streisand.
Yeah, Foster the People did their last record, tracked here for 6 weeks. And sometimes people Pink and, goes on and on. Coldplay has been working here. Chris Martin. Sometimes people rent the whole property, and my wife and I go on a trip, go to Bali or go to Florida, go visit relatives, go have fun. So it's been a really nice experience having built this studio. I followed my passion for how I wanted a studio to work, and it was definitely kind of my own little musical Seward's Folly. For those of you who aren't history buffs, Seward's Folly was otherwise known as Alaska. I bought Alaska, and everybody thought he paid too much money for it, and he did at the time, but then, of course, it turned out to be this huge, resource-rich area. Well, that's kind of what this is like. Like, if you look at it on the face of it, it was the stupidest thing ever to spend as much money as I did building the studio. But in retrospect and over time, it's more than paid for itself in many ways. So it's been great.
One of the cooler things, and the engineer in me right now, I have the hat on, is the fact that you have a small basement where you have two ISO rooms, one for a Leslie and the other for a guitar amp cabinet, which I think is just brilliant. It's just brilliant.
Well, you know, I got that idea from Jonathan Davis. The singer in Korn had built a studio in his house and had or in the garage of his house in the valley, and he had a live room. But something he did I thought was kind of silly but cool at the same time, it kind of inspired me, is in the middle of the live room, he built another room that was an amp closet. And it was just this cube in the middle of the room where he could put an amp and have it at blistering volume and still have somebody singing in the same room. So I just took that idea and said, well, why have it take up floor space? Let's just put it down below because it's just a windowless cube for an amp. We can have it completely out of the way. And so we built two of them, and that was the inspiration for that.
Yeah, that's great. And the other thing is the fact that the workstation can move around. It doesn't have to be in the same spot all the time, which, again, is great. And what that does is it opens up other combinations where if you need more space for more musicians, then you can do that. And that's just a fabulous idea.
It also it's also kind of a psychological thing, too. It's fun to be, when you're working on a long-term project, I produced this band Isley here a few years back, and you know, we're set up for tracking the band's playing, but then every once in a while we would literally just completely move the whole room around, just change everything. Just put the piano in a different area, put the recording console in a different place, move the speakers, put up a TV monitor, and close all the blinds and give it a completely different vibe. And just change, you could completely morph the feel of the room. So that's again, important emotionally. So that makes it fun. And practically, too. And by the way, the movable wall idea came from Capitol. Down at, a lot of
right.
people don't know that, you know, down in the Capitol Records building in Hollywood, there are these fantastic studios down in the basement. And in between the two biggest rooms, A and B, there is a wall that collapses. And I had worked there for years not knowing that wall collapsed. It just looked like a solid wall. I never even thought to look at it. And then one day I was looking to record an orchestra, and all the normal scoring stages in town were booked. And the studio manager there, Paula, called me up and said, we can fit your orchestra in here. We just collapsed that wall, and we spill over from A into B. And that light bulb went off for me then. And, you know, again, one of those little ideas I just stored away in my head. And when this opportunity came up to build this place, I called up Paula and said, could you give me the name of that company that built those walls? And we worked with them to design this system, which is massively more complex because of the angles that we're playing with here, but same idea.
Oh, I didn't realize that it was the same people that did both of them. Oh, okay.
Same company, yeah.
So but that came from Germany, right?
No, that's the, you're thinking of the, there are other doors that go to the outside, these sliders that were custom made in Germany that lock down once they're in place, these mahogany sliders, they lock down against the floor and become a wall. They look like a window, or they become, you know, this big solid window, but they're actually sliders that move. Those were made in Germany, but the wall system, this aluminum wall system, it's all, you don't see the aluminum, it's all covered. That was made down in Orange County.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that makes it easy. They're local, yeah, so that's a good thing.
And the other thing was interesting is we had the original plan for the studio was pretty much a standard studio with a, you know, control room and a live room and a vocal booth and a little machine room. And we had budgeted, we had gotten as far as budgeting that out, and I wanted, you know, the doors, the get those nice studio sliders. I could see at any good studio, you know, big, nice wooden sliding doors, right, that open and seal nice and tight. By the time I built the walls and those, or would have built the walls and no sliders, it would have ended up costing me more than what we did with this movable wall system. It was actually less expensive.
Wow.
And, and infinitely more flexible.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, I really wanted to talk to you about being a studio musician because I know you've done hundreds of sessions and working with Tom Jones and your Robert Palmer story, which are great. But I don't want to keep you too much longer because we've been on for quite a while, longer than I promised. So,
Well, you can keep me as long as you want, but you might bore your listeners.
Well, I don't think so. It's been great so far. Last question then.
Okay.
What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever received or you learned, music business advice?
Well, there's a couple. One came too late. I wish I had heard it, and or at least it had registered with me when I was younger. And it came from, of all people, Kobe Bryant. I just heard him say this on an interview one day, talking about negotiating his contract or something. And this was many years ago. And he said, don't chase money, let money chase you.
Oh,
I love that.
Yeah.
And I wish that I had known that and taken it to heart, and I probably wouldn't have back in the day when I was a kid and money is, you know, rearing its head, like, I can make more money, I can do this, and make more money. And you quite often, more often than not, you make the wrong decision if you're basing it on money.
Yeah.
And I did. Time and time again. You know, there are many career choices I wish I could take back because I did something for the money instead of for the love of it. So there's that. And the one thing that I always say to, you know, I speak at colleges and so on, at, you know, my alma mater at Berkeley or at USC or Columbia College or wherever. I always point out to wannabe people in the music business and film composers, session players, doesn't matter, engineers, whatever you want to be. I always say, if you're home, you're losing. Just never be home. Just be out of your house. If you're watching TV, you're done. You've got to get out of the house. It doesn't matter what you do. Just get out. Just go out and do things. You know, it's like that line in Annie Hall by Woody Allen, you know, it's like a shark. If you're not moving, you die. So I've, you know, taken that to heart. And I try to not be just sitting around not doing anything.
I
think it's helpful to anybody to do that. And then one other thing is that I've definitely learned is I see a lot of people coming into the business now, and I'm sure it was true when I was coming in too, that they're looking at it like, well, what can you do for me? How much are you going to pay me, or how's this going to help my career? And that kind of attitude, and that again, you're dead in the water if you think like that. Your attitude has to be, how can I help you? It has to be the first thing when you meet somebody, whether it's a director or anybody. It's like, how can I help you? I mean, really what it gets down to, I think, what improves human endeavor overall is doing something for the greater good and doing something to make life a more pleasant existence for everybody, or at least for somebody. So, that's certainly my, my guiding light. That makes sense?
It certainly does. That's some great tips there. Very, very simple. You know, I ask this question of everyone I have on, and sometimes I get a long, rambling answer that doesn't answer the question. And this is great. You gave three really good pieces of advice in a really great, concise way that everybody can relate to. It's awesome, Richard.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much for being on. I appreciate it. This has been great.
Well, thank you for allowing me to babble on.
You can babble on anytime.
All right. Well, you can call me anytime then.
Okay. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Bobby.
Find out more about Richard and Woodshed Recording. Go to woodshedrecording.com. That's woodshedrecording, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. I want to thank Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put this together. Thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab. Or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.